Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harp Song for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs by Marguerite Young. We are on page 130. And this is a longish chapter. And if somebody comes trotting up the stairs, the cats were playing parkour earlier in the house, and if someone comes tromping up the stairs, I'll try and cover my best to cover the mic and keep going. I didn't feel like closing the door, and it's the last nice day outside. It's gonna be, is the temperature gonna drop like 30 degrees? But that's where I live. Chapter 37. And I decided, I made a couple of decisions today, but I tried to do the reading to keep up with the read along with Paper Pills. If you're following along, it's on Blue Sky, hashtag MYoung23. Really great quotes. Paper Pills is really picking out some great quotes. She's good at that. I'm not so much. And then when I do pick out, I read hers and I thought, yep, that's the same thing I thought. So if you're following along there, but I am not going to. I tried. I did. I really tried to see if I could just read do the podcast as many pages as in the reading. It's not going to work. It's just not going to work. Okay, so let's get this done. After a time of trying to support himself and his wife by doing a little work with his hands on the farm as if he had been the son of a clod instead of the son of God, Joseph Smith had received a visit from the Lord, who had come to tell him that his forgetfulness as to what was in the lost text word for word need provide no difficulty. That could not be solved by what might have been called a kind of hiatus, a breakage or cleft or cessura or fissure in memory. The angel Moroni was that rara avis, I guess, which would not repeat himself and thus was different from those many angels of the heavenly sphere at every level who lived by repeating themselves, I'm dying of heat. Oh my gosh, I know I have the air on. Many angels of the heavenly sphere at every level who lived by repeating themselves, by saying over and over what they had just said. Joseph Smith should discontinue his weeping and continue with another version of the word of the Lord, which could be subjected to so many interpretations, including one's own. As Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery were low on coins of gold, silver, copper, tin, other than coins of speech, stamped with faces of kings of Phoenician, Babylonian, Sumerian, Egyptian empires, which they had possibly also a limited supply, and as they had not ever the coins of beaver and otter empires with which to pay for bread and bed as they continued the translation of the Indian Bible that would bring to the darkness of this world the honeycomb of light, they had gratefully accepted the invitation of Peter Whitmer and his sons to eat and sleep in their home in Fayette, Seneca County, New York, while the work of translation went on, not speedily as a winged horse, but slow as a workman's horse. Once more behind a curtain that divided God's prophet from his translator, although there was no partition of any kind between their two brains, the prophet with his peepstone piped out the holy words of this strange and yet familiar text, which was to be but a shortened version, an epitome of the original, which had weighed 40 pounds and had been reduced in passage from one world to another world, even like so many things which are lost between the conception and the act, the dream and the reality. Helping with the translation over a period of 7 months, which should have been 9 in which to allow it to develop before lifting it up from the womb of time, had been Peter Whitmer's sons and sometimes Emma, mother of the child whose little imago had apparently not been protected by the talismanic angel of childbirth and who had been born dead. Around the dining table in Seneca County, Peter Whitmer's sons, Christian and David, had joined in a cottage industry in which they not only served as scribes taking down Joseph Smith's dictation, which came from behind the green curtain like some great weaver's loom from which the harp music spilled, they also, although they had not yet seen the golden plates of which the discovery must be taken on faith, as they heard sounds like hands moving among strings, perhaps the hand of that great creator while in flight, had let loose and dropped from his hand the egg out of which, when it was cracked, all the forms of creation had spilled, had attempted to arrange in a semblance of the logic of a creator who had antedated logic, the fractured, disjointed grammar of the translation of the orthography. Remnants of mythologies, older than those of the generally accepted Bible, were very real in Joseph Smith's mythology, which antedated the traditional religions and had brushed upon him with their plumes. It's no doubt also during the period of their exile they had been somewhat under the mesmerizing spell of Phoenicians, Greeks, Cretans, Arabs, Persians, Egyptians, Etruscans, and various other pagan deities in a timeless time of many migrations, meltings, mergings, meetings, partings, and many changes in forms of gods. The prophet's ignorance of the Bible had been so great that he had not known that Jerusalem was a walled city until one of his helper scribes told him. It would be recalled by David Whitmer in an interview of the Chicago Tribune of December 15, 1885, at a time when counting strikes by usually foreign-born workers for the 8-hour day so that they might sometimes see the faces of their children when they were wide awake and smiling in the light of the sun, had ripened the ground for the strike against the McCormick Reaper Works in Chicago, where the angel who presided over the works was not the harvester angel Gabriel, as what was harvested here by the reaper was not corn with the grain still on the listening ear, but those poor naked cobs who were men. The long-ago founder of the Mormon Church, whose people had never starved through any carelessness of his, had drawn into orbit a variety of feathered birdmen, including the Egyptian falcon with the eye of Horus, who, when he was brought down from the skies by the arrows of a pagan archer, was comforted in the lap of the earth mother Isis, who perhaps had prepared the way for the mother of Christ when he, with his bloody wounds and marks of spears and flames upon him, was taken down from the cross and comforted in her lap, as if he were still her little child, as he was still the carpenter's son, and no doubt he was. The trouble with Joseph Smith was that he wished to be taken seriously, in spite of the joking spirit in him which was generally recognized. A toad had shown him the way into the man-made cave to show him the golden plates, which were still invisible to others, and which had been placed there by Moroni, a man who was not an angel in the beginning, but had become an angel after he had been buried here, and had ascended to heaven as a spirit who now had returned through the pearly gates as an angel. Joseph Smith's pride in having the invisible golden plates in his possession had seemed to make him swell larger and larger, like the mythic frog who had swallowed all the waters of the world, and was afraid to open his mouth lest they should all come spewing out, and he should be a dead frog, as inept as a brown leaf swept along by wind. The title page had explained in a way to appeal to the spirit of adventure inherent in the breasts of many Americans, but not all, that this new Bible on which Joseph Smith held the copyright was an abridgment of the record of the people of Nephi, and also of the Lamanites, and was written to the Lamanites, a remnant of the house of Israel, and also to Jew and Gentile, written and sealed up, and hid up unto the Lord, to come forth by the gift and power of God unto the interpretation thereof, sealed by the hand of Moroni, and hid up unto the Lord, to come forth in due time by the way of Gentile, the interpretation thereof by the gift of God. The book was further described as an abridgment of the book of Ether, which was a record of the people of Jared, and if anyone wondered who they were or what language they had spoken, there was now given enlightenment as to further mysteries caused by the failure of communication in a universal tongue, such as many socialists had dreamed of and would continue to dream of. The promise being that if men understood each other, and if all excesses of languages buried in languages were stripped away, they would live in great harmony and less chaos than now. This book, reduced in form, although certainly not to the smallest capsule possible, for if it were small enough, a man might have eaten it as if it were a lightning bug, had been written when the Lord scattered the people of Jared and confounded the language of the people when they were building a tower to get to heaven. No doubt the Lord had split and divided the language of the builders into a babel of tongues, because he had had it in mind not only to discourage the search for social perfection by the mud-bound, sand-bound, water-bound children of earth, but to give comfort and employment to the grim fairy tale man in whom probably more Americans, whether high up or low down upon the scale of success, believed than believed in Martin Luther's God or John Calvin's God. J-E-A-N. I thought it was John. The name that Cornelius Vanderbilt had placed upon his first freight boat steaming up the Hudson had been, for example, the Cinderella. after that little girl who had sat among the ashes and had turned into just such a gold as would the coal brought by the water barges before there were land barges or ships on rails. Joseph Smith's search had not been for perfection, but for improvement of man's lot on earth. In order to find financial backing for the publication of the abridgment of God's word into a form that was not merely a capsule, assuring peace to the believers who were the children of light and not of darkness, the prophet had been told by Moroni, the son of Moron. No way. M-O-R-O-N-I. M-O-R-O-N-I. Moroni, right? Right? Moroni? The son of M-O-R-O-N? M-O-R-O-N? Moron? 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 Whose muse must certainly have been not the muse of memory, which was the mother of the arts, but the muse of forgetfulness. That the Lord had changed his mind, and that it behooved him to allow the translators to see the golden plates that had previously been hidden from them. The bound, paper-backed visions that were looking for financial backing in a publisher, and were not blank pages, and were bound together so that the pages would not fly apart in the wind, and the messages would not be lost, irretrievably lost. Although after centuries in a cave they had come to man, and so ought always to be able to return, had been seen and handled by the translators who had previously been as blind as three blind mice, at least just so long as it was not a haystack burning in the midst of the flood. The three witnesses to whom an angel had come down from heaven bearing the golden plates, which they were allowed to see with their eyes and touch with their fingers, were Oliver Cowdery, former schoolmaster and former blacksmith, who was to do his hammering henceforth upon the forges of the Lord, the translator, David Whitmer, whose fathers and brothers were also to testify, as would Hiram Page and Joseph Smith, Sr., and his sons, Hiram and Samuel H. Smith, beloved sons of the former gold hunter father, who was not to waver in his faith that the son who bore his name was the vehicle or vessel for that which he called the genius of his wandering family. And finally, Martin Harris, the black sheep who had wandered away from the old fold, but now had wandered back. To Martin Harris, with his purse strings drawn as tight as the mouth of a dead man trying not to cough up the gold coin for his passage through the ever-widening Stygian flood to the shores of light, God had sent, by way of Joseph Smith as his messenger and servant, a message that, had he been in a colloquial mood as he sometimes was, he should cough up. God had commanded Martin Harris to make haste to repent, he being in the presence of the eternity of God and the potency of his punishments, of which, of course, he had already experienced some. It seemed that if he had sinned in his haste because of his selfishness, he was to be given no time in which to repent at his leisure. If he did not immediately repent in order to piece out the payment of the bill that he had contracted with the printer at a time when Joseph Smith, the ne'er-do-well, could get no credit from the devil's printer for setting up the Lord's words, God would smite him by the rod upon his mouth, and by his wrath, and by his anger. So his sufferings would be sore. How sore he knew not. Whatever he may have thought, how exquisite he knew not. And again, I command thee that thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor seek thy neighbor's life. Polygamy at this point having been not so much as a sudden flock of startled thoughts rising up in the prophet's mind, as a way of making sure his earthly paradise would have inhabitants, and he not empty as a dry well. And again, I command thee that thou shalt not covet thine own property, but impart it freely to the printing of the Book of Mormon. And the Lord would not release him from bondage until he had done so. And the Lord did not want to have to speak of the matter again. So that Martin Harris, repenting of the sins that had made him covet his own property as that which he did not wish to share with other men, the concept having not yet arrived that as one should not sequester one's own gold coins away from the all-encompassing community of saints under the protection of God, one also should not own the body of one's wife, but should share her as if she were common stock in which other saints and possibly even angels had their joints as of the fruits of their loins, as more than one frog prince, dreaming that he was a man, might have dropped his seeds into the same many-furrowed earth tossing up and down like a sea. Had been urged to borrow on his farm, land, or sell it outright, in order to pay the printer who had gone on strike and had refused to continue with his work, or word which he who might well have been the devil fallen from a high estate in the clouds to his present low estate in the mud had no reason to take on trust either the Lord or the Lord's emissary here on earth, whether true or false. Among the many tales told regarding the circumstances of the revelation of the golden plates and the three original witnesses was that they had at first seen nothing they were supposed to see. When Joseph Smith had opened what seemed the golden box in which the golden plates had been enclosed, there had been not so much as a flash of golden lightning forks lighting the heavens and casting a reflection upon earth. Their hearts had been smitten with disappointment. "O ye of little faith," the prophet had cried out, "how long will God bear with this wicked and perverse generation? Down on your knees, brethren, every one of you," he commanded, and they had knelt. According to the possibly somewhat foggy recollections of David Whitmer in a Democratic organ, the Kingston, Missouri Times of December 27, 1887, and that was in the month following the execution of the Haymarket anarchists, whose guilt was never to be established beyond the shadow of a doubt, and who were tried and condemned only for having spread the drizzly atmosphere which had inspired someone else to throw the bomb in the Haymarket Square, there had appeared in the heavens the miracle that was the affirmation of the miracle for which the gentleman had waited. A slowly floating table upon which were many golden plates piled... Piled high as a tower, a table where the members of the Church of Latter-day Saints should share the fruits of life, and the long-necked golden goose stretched out upon its golden platter in a communitarian brotherhood of saints and angels, where to all members would be given bread and not merely the crumbs, or possibly not even the crumbs, which in this present society of rich men were not allotted to the poor tramps and bums who were left to starve like scrawny blackbirds in the snow. For there would be the realization of Joseph Smith's dream of a new Jerusalem rising up out of this dead sea of life, or coming down through heaven's gates, as had been promised long ago and quite recently. The golden plates were those which had provided material for the Mormon Bible, in which these three witnesses had seen for the first time as the scales dropped from their eyes, and the sky that had previously been darkness without light had been filled with a light more glorious than that of the sun, and they had also heard the voice of the Lord speaking to them. According to Martin Harris, he had not seen them with his natural or bodily eyes, as he might see a pencil case in a lawyer's hand. He had seen them with the eye of faith, just as distinctly as he might see anything around him, although at the time of the revelation they had been covered by a cloth. When the Mormon temple was built at Kirtland, Ohio, by the Mormon saints, who were even then always being threatened with extinction by their persecutors, one of the ways by which man's vision had been magnetized by the convert Brigham Young, stonemason and carpenter and painter and glazier by trade, and also adept in speaking mysterious angel tongues, bird tongues, frog tongues, just as Joseph Smith was, had been for him to work with an early Canadian convert on the mixing of the plaster for the outer walls, with no jewels from Solomon's undiscovered mine, such as might have been preferred by the average man, but with gleaming fragments of china dishes, which caught the light of the sun and the moon, and which had been contributed to the dauber's buyer of sand, water, lime, and sometimes human hair, by the Mormon women who gathered at the dinner table. It was the way of the 12 saints, who had been chosen by the three original eyewitnesses to set up stakes for the catching of an angel of the Lord if they waited long enough. Brigham Young's view having been that if one or many angels would come, they would come whether they were expected or unexpected. Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery had seen at the temple various sacred characters from the past, which they believed, in spite of all the storm and stress of life, was the present and future for them and those who were sharers of their faith. Among these visitors who kept the heavens busy with their traffic, the long-bearded Moseses with the keys of the gathering and the return of the 10 tribes, Elias with the keys of the dispensation of Abraham, Elijah with the keys of redemption and sealing. One of the buildings erected by Brigham Young was the post office. Although all three of the early witnesses were to sever the cords that bound them to Joseph Smith, all three were to continue to believe in the authenticity of the mysterious golden plates when they might have joined with howling mobs to say that they were false. That pronouncement would have meant that they themselves were guilty either of plain, open-faced falsehood or biased judgment, which might have robbed them of their desire to be considered honorable men in relation to the fraud that they could see was Joseph Smith, who had seemed too much a clown to be a god, and who was like a ventriloquist, able to speak from a cloud, a stone, a pebble, a hole in the sand, a tree blowing the wind at the edge of the ever-crumbling abyss, and against whom the three dummies had rebelled again because of disappointed opportunism in a real or an imaginary sense. The three original witnesses, who never did recant and tell the truth that anti-Mormon watchers yearned to hear, that the Book of Mormon was of no known divine origin, and the golden plates that they had promoted in the darkness were a fraud, promoted by a fraud, who was interested in the money that could be brought by sales. Sales of books, and not sales of boats, manned by angels, especially Moroni, who was the head of the crew, were to enjoy greater longevity than that given to the great illuminator, his life to be cut short by the violent mob and the flower of his manhood, whereas their lives were to go on and on, possibly as a reward from God for their reticence. They were keeping their mouths as silent as if stuffed with old birds' nests, pebbles, and clay when time after time they were approached after their falling away from the Mormon faith as headed by the dead or transfigured or transported prophet. They still had refused to speak the truth that would have revealed them as false witnesses. The three original witnesses had remained true to the angelic experience which they had shared. Although Martin Harris had departed from the company of Joseph Smith, he had not fallen so far away from the tree of life, that he could not find his way back to take another baptismal dip in the river, so that he who had been an apostate had been restored as a member of the Mormon Church when God cast upon the waters his golden net to bring him in. Bring him in, bring him in. He had been a flounder, so bring him in and let him flounder like a loose garment upon the shore of sand and snow and mud. His last words, when he was dying at the age of 92, and must have known that he was passing from the light into the darkness or the darkness into the light, were remembered to have been, according to ear and eyewitnesses who had gathered at his bedside, the words, book, book, book. After all, he had not only seen the golden plates like the flash of sunlight inside the box, he had tried to retrieve his original monetary losses by taking greater loans upon his farm, and so had become the bookmaker or publisher, as he had also become the bookmaker of the shill, urging people to put their money on the four horsemen who would carry the believers in Moroni's golden plates to the promised land. Martin Harris, although not an authentic carrier of the vision, for he was a money grubber, grubbing only for himself, had foreseen such a great landslide of converts to the Mormon faith that had been served in the plates of gold by the angel messenger that it was not difficult for him to bet that the United States government was on the verge of falling, and not in the very remote future, but very soon. For the Mormons were spreading, increasing their number, and were about to take over this land root and branch, and not leave it to its present driftage and seeming chaos, as the powers of Washington seemed to do in relation to the poor, who were trammeled on by the trammelers, as they were generally called. When Oliver Cowdery was approaching his end, he had not turned turtle by denying that he had seen the golden plates. They, after all, had been the initial illusion ushering in other illusions, such as those of the sacred prophets of old, who in answer to his bird whistles and those of others of the Mormon saints with whom he had parted some time ago, had come out of the sky into the marshes near Kirtland in order to appear in the great golden temple before the eyes of the mesmerized members of the church. What if he now denied that he had seen Moses or Elijah or John the Baptist, and no sooner was dead than one of them would meet him with reproach? His last words, according to Brother David Whitmer, a not unprejudiced witness, had been a reminder to him that he should not forget what he had seen, and should be true to his testimony of the Book of Mormon and the golden plates from which they had translated it leaf by leaf. What had perhaps swept over David Whitmer's mind before his physical senses faded and his spiritual senses like eyes were returned to some great cloud bank was perhaps the idea of an oversoul or an idea existing in an angel's mind. He had felt no great crack-up of his brain, no splitting, no division as into two melon halves, but had been very clear and lucid, and probably more than usually sane. So, beyond the help of any prescription, other than that Nepenthean patent medicine, which should put the old man to sleep until he should awaken in paradise at the sound of the ram's horn, he had called the doctor to his bedside for the express purpose of ascertaining whether or not he was in his right mind. The doctor examined him with a stethoscope, telescope, microscope, tuning forks, or whatever instruments were in his bag, and had assured him that his mind was shipshape. He probably was not leaking out part of his mind, and was not already a mere paper skull. Whitmer had answered all questions. He had known whether it was day or night, He had known which country he was in, as could not be said of all dying men, and he was going to clear the deck. He was not going to his grave without taking his revenge upon those who had believed he was a liar, and awaited hopefully for his deathbed recantations. The Richmond, Missouri Democrat had reported that the old man, just before giving up the ghost, had called out to the eyewitnesses of what must have been his final passage, "I want to say to you all, the Bible and the records of the Nephites is true." Thus the words carved on the tombstone that marked the grave of the rasping old man who had claimed that he was not unhinged, but who long ago had fallen from the Mormon tree of life, could have come as no surprise to those who watched over what should be called the Department of Last Words. The record of the Jews and the record of the Nephites are one. Truth is eternal. All right, yes, okay. Getting into some longer chapters. Oh, goodness. Let me see. I can usually make it that far. Oh no. Marguerite Young is picking up speed. All right, well. I'm hoping I can hang in there. Yeah, the chapters are getting longer, definitely. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. Oh, we are almost to part two. I did not realize there were parts. Okay, so we're on chapter 38, page 139. And on 178, we start part two. Okay, and then part two actually starts off with Daniel Debs, so we'll probably get back into Debs at that part. But okay, so then, oh, I was kind of having fun with these chapters being shorter. Okay, we go back to short chapters for at least a while. All right, lots more reading to get to. Thank you for listening. I hope you're well wherever you are. Bye.